Hey everyone, welcome back to Impossible Trade-Offs. I am your host, Katie Harbath. Today I'm bringing you a conversation with my leadership team at Duco. Duco is the consulting firm that I joined in January. We work with a lot of different tech companies on a wide variety of issues, a lot of them in the trust and safety space. And I thought it might be interesting to bring Sydney Olenek, who is the founder and CEO, Scott, who is our CTO, and Nima, who is our chief operating officer, and myself to talk not only a little bit about the company. I promise you it's not a sales podcast, but just to share a bit more about sort of the trends we are seeing, some of the things we're being asked for a lot by clients, the type of problems that we're working on, et cetera. And so I hope you enjoy. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Impossible Trade-Offs. I've got Team Duco with me today. Welcome, everybody.
Excited to be here.
Howdy, y'all.
Yes.
Sydney, Nima, and Scott, who are my co-workers now at Duco. And I thought today I wanted to give an opportunity for them to all share a little bit more about themselves, some of the things we're seeing in the trust and safety industry and all of that good jazz. But let's start with just a round of introductions for listeners who might not know who you all are. Sydney, let's start with you first.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Katie. Very excited to be here. Of course, big fan of the podcast, and it'll be fun to kind of go down memory lane with all of you guys here. So by way of background, I'm the CEO at Duco today. I spent my formative years in Washington, D.C., and when I say formative years, I mean my 20s. I worked in nonprofits, startups, and governments there. I think the two most important jobs that led me to Duco are one, I worked in the Obama administration. I was the chief of staff of Middle East policy in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And so in that capacity, did a lot of interagency work and met a number of different national security and foreign policy experts in that role. And then before that, I worked at a place called the Truman National Security Project, where I led all of the membership. So I was in charge of that fellowship program. You may have heard of the Nerdy National Security Fellows there. And also a number of the other membership programs and human rights programs. And so my job there was to become friends with the next generation of foreign policy and national security leaders. And so I think those two jobs in particular, I think kind of paved the way for me to start Duco. I'll also just mention that my parents were both entrepreneurs as well. So I think I was kind of just born with that itch.
Very cool. Scott, let's go to you next.
All right. Thank you, Katie. And thank you for having us. It's a pleasure to be here with y'all. So my background and the way that I ended up at Duco actually started outside of the tech world. I was a grad student working towards my PhD in physics. And we were doing this experiment where we collected 3 whole gigabytes of data. That was back in the day when 3 gigabytes would make your laptop say uncle. And so essentially I had to learn how to write code in order to figure out how to analyze data for an experiment. So that got me into the world of coding, and I pretty quickly left academia for the wonderful world of technology startups. And as soon as I landed there, I found my happy place. Really, my career over the last 13 years has really been focused around getting out there and building things that help companies grow and get off the ground. The real early stage, the experiments, the world of, is this going to work? Is this not going to work? How can we just will this thing into existence? That's really where I thrive. On the way to finding Duco, I ran a couple of tech consulting agencies. And so this idea of having a flexible team that can come in and help you achieve your goals, one that's really focused on customer service and helping the client succeed and having our success come through that, that's really something that kind of flows through my veins. It's a part of my DNA. And so getting to be here with the team at Duco, building tooling that is helping keep the world sane and helping professionals operate safely and securely in this world, it's really been a wonderful coming together of a lot of threads in my history. Got a few more interesting stories to tell, but I think we'll get into those through the conversation today, and I will leave it there.
Amazing. And last but not least, Nima.
Yeah, thank you, Katie, and thank you for having us. So Nima, I am the COO of Duco. I've been with the company now for just about 3 years. Before that, spent about a dozen years in Washington, D.C., similar to Sid, started kind of my career in D.C., and really was in a bunch of different consulting organizations during that time. So I had the good fortune to work across different sectors. So I did private sector consulting, public sector consulting, as you can imagine, DC, that's a significant contingent of work there, nonprofit sector as well. And I kind of refined my overall kind of client service toolkit in those, you know, dozen or so years. I think the things that stick out for me from that time in there that have applied to my time at Duco are, one, I just really enjoyed the idea of working with a client on a really complex problem. And I think that is something that is very emotionally fulfilling for me and something that is intellectually stimulating for me. And so I've had a chance to do that now at Duco for the past 3 years. And I think that's a really fun part of the job that we all get to do every day. And then the second thing that sticks out, and this is, I think, reflective of my time working with government and my time working with mission-driven organizations, I think buying into the mission of an organization or an agency, depending on the context, was also a big part of fulfillment for me. I found that, you know, when I was working with those teams or those colleagues of those organizations, the way they thought about their work was elevated beyond just kind of a bottom line. And I think that was a reason to go kind of above and beyond, both on their behalf and to make them be successful. And so I think a lot of that has translated as well to my Duco environment, which I'm very thankful for.
So before we go any further, I think it'd be really helpful if, Sydney, you can give an overview of what Duco is, the type of work that we do. And then I want to dig into a little bit of the backstory, but let's just start kind of with the overview for folks that may not be familiar with us.
Yeah, absolutely. So today we primarily work with internet companies, some of the largest platform companies, AI companies, and gaming companies in the world, and we help them navigate incredibly complex challenges. And so we have thousands of experts in over 70 countries, and those experts, we can put together teams of those experts on specific issues to help clients. And so we work and kind of provide surge capacity to our clients on everything from like elections, red teaming, and you know, training AI models, fraud and scams, and basically like the issue of the day. We primarily work with intelligence, security, trust and safety, and policy teams. And when I say policy, I mean the whole range: public policy, policy development, policy enforcement, etc. And so I think, particularly over the last 18 months, as the internet industry has shifted so quickly, we've had a really special opportunity to support these companies through a lot of these changes and sort of sit at the edge of a lot of these emerging issues. So that's essentially where we are today. I think looking back, there are a lot of things that are similar about what we have today and where we started out. And there are a lot of things that have changed. We initially started working across multiple industries. And so we worked in banking and financial services and was with hedge funds and oil and gas companies and biotech and defense. And at a point a few years in, our product market fit was just so strong with internet companies that we essentially kind of, you know, let a lot of those other contracts fade out, and we doubled down and actually grew significantly once we decided to kind of focus. I could see us expanding again into some other sectors, but for today, I think we have really good, basically our differentiators, I think, really serve internet companies really well. And happy to pop back to the beginning and tell some funny stories and dive in there at any point, Katie, but I'll stop and see
I think some stories would be great. And particularly, I think both for you and Scott, because you're kind of there from the beginning, but Nima, also jump in too. You know, I think we have a lot of listeners that are probably, you know, they may have unfortunately been part of the tech layoffs that have happened, people that are trying to think about, you know, what they should be doing next in their career. How do they maybe get something started? And so I think a little bit more of some of those stories of, you know, you did a lot of iterating and pivoting and stuff like that, that I think might be helpful for folks who might look at this and be like, think that you woke up and waved a magic wand and you knew what you were going to do and you were getting these contracts right away, when that's not really the case.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll start by saying, I think there's so many lessons. I literally could talk for hours on the different lessons that we've learned. I think one of the quickest things that just hit me in the face when we started the company was, it's probably one of the most unglamorous things I've ever done. And I think no one understands that. I think being a startup founder, people think it's very glamorous, but you're often sitting alone in your living room and you feel like you have like a lemonade stand and no one's showing up. And so I think just pushing through that first couple of years, it builds so much resilience. And it's amazing how quick eventually you just stand back up and you just get so used to rejection. And so I think it's the most, also the most fulfilling thing I've ever done. And so I think it's absolutely worth it. But I think that people need to manage their expectations, that it is a grind. And you really have to be at the right place in your life, and the right mentality, and frankly, be able to take on a lot of risk. I mean, there were the first $20,000 of money we spent, you know, we put on personal credit cards. And so those are, you know, some of the things you just have to think about when you're getting started. I will say that we got into an accelerator out here. NFX is a venture capital firm that is based in San Francisco, and they used to have an accelerator program. We were the last class that went through it. But at the time I was living in Washington, D.C., and one of the partners, Gigi, told me that we got into the program, but we needed to have an engineer on our team before we started. And I had about 10 to 14 days to move to California to start the program, but also to convince someone. I told, you know, I was like, yeah, we have a great pipeline of talent and we can definitely onboard someone by then, but scrambled to find an engineer. And I think the first funny story is how Scott and I met. We met through, and Scott, I'm going to turn over to you to give your perspective on this in a second, but we met through an introduction, and we met one time for coffee. At that coffee, I was like, he doesn't look like a murderer. I offered him the job, and then we proceeded to move in together. Katie, I know that you know my husband. So my then boyfriend, Scott, and I all moved in after we met one time, and our living room was the office. And Scott, I'm curious from your perspective, but it was the wildest summer, probably the wildest summer of my life. And also like one of the most fun things, but, crazy just to like move in with a stranger and decide to work together 12 hours a day. But yeah, Scott, I'll let you take it from there.
What made you say yes and want to do that?
Great question. So I got connected to Sid through a mutual contact named Mike Michella. I had worked with Mike at Nation Builder, which is a community organizing and advocacy tech platform. And Mike was a member of the Truman Project with Sydney. And so he connected us. I was looking for an adventure. Sid seemed like an awesome person who was building excellent things. And honestly, it just came down to going up to my wife at the time, who was in law school, and saying, hey, love, I'm going to go move in on this woman's couch for the next 3 months in another city a few hours away. But don't worry, we're going to build excellent stuff. This is going to be great. Bless her heart. She let me go do that. And we went through the most fun, most unglamorous summer, as Sid undersold the unglam earlier. I'll unpack that a little bit. Unglamorous in the early days meant that the 11 folks working on this project all went to sit in Andy's house every day to work out of the living room. And I shared a restroom with all of these folks, which was a pretty fantastic little detail. It was, you know, a banker in London taking a call at 2 a.m, our time, my first day on the job, and being woken up to troubleshoot something that was going on at the time. And all this was going on while we're doing dishes for everybody, running experiments. Some things work, some things don't. And it was just a crash course in moving fast, trying things, and moving on.
Let's not forget about the ant infestation, Scott.
There was an ant infestation. Streams of ants like you've never seen before.
Actual bugs in the product.
Yeah. Climbed in the laptop. No, it was great. What was another fun one? When Andy, Sid's husband, was cleaning the house, he broke my brand new computer monitor, which was a lot of fun. And it's like I moved in with these people for 2 weeks. It was an honest mistake. It was all in good fun.
Yeah. What was the original concept for Duco? Because, you know, most people, I think, are familiar with traditional consulting firms that do that sort of stuff. But you all also have a platform. Not you all. I'm part of the family now. Have been part of the family for a while. There's a platform that's powering it as well. And so I'm curious, like, what the original vision was for the company and why you wanted to marry the software solutions with the consulting ones, for either Sid or Scott, whoever wants to take that.
Oh, okay. I'll go for it. So in the early days, we were coming to this thinking that we were going to build a two-sided marketplace. The joke I used to tell was, you know, we're Upwork for spies. We've definitely come a long way in the same
We are not spies then. For anybody listening.
Yeah. Okay. We can cut that out. That's fine. So the real idea back then was to build a marketplace, sort of like Upwork, where folks could come in and schedule phone calls in a completely self-service manner to essentially get at the information and intelligence they need to solve their job. We went through a lot of iterations in going through and building that platform out. And eventually what we came to find was that hiring a contractor can be a fairly overwhelming process for end users, right? You're searching through in a field that you don't have the expertise in that field. That's why you're seeking help. And so you're going through all these contractors and profiles. And what we found was people were kind of getting stuck in going through this process in a self-service manner. So sort of over time, we started with a platform that we thought was the whole thing, the whole product that we'd be offering to customers. And as time went on, the mechanics of how this met the market showed us that this tool really turned into an internal superpower that allowed our Duco team to navigate through all of these contractors very efficiently. There's a lot of tricky stuff where contractors work occasionally. You're not going to work with them regularly. And so if you want to work with someone who hasn't done a project in 8 months, how are you tracking that work history? How do you know who worked with them before? Are they a good match for this type of project? And so this platform that we built to manage contractors ended up being our internal superhero cape that, you know, turned us from a consulting agency that you would be used to working with to a highly efficient consulting agency that allowed us to solve our customers' problems in a way that would have been impossible if we were still working in spreadsheets and email inboxes and the like.
Well, and that's a great segment for me to go to Nima. Nima, you help run the team that kind of works directly day to day with our clients and stuff like that. Can you go into a little bit more of the types of requests that we tend to get for clients and the type of work that we're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been interesting to see kind of the evolution of our work, and at least in the 3 years that I've been here, which I think is kind of representative of the Duco pivot that happened after the kind of initial forming that Sydney and Scott alluded to. And I think we're seeing some common thematic elements across clients. So things like policy reviews that we do a lot of, things like election monitoring that we do a lot of, things like red teaming of AI that increasingly we're doing a lot of. I think what's really been clear this year, and I think probably starting last year, and Katie, you touched on it briefly before, was there's a couple narratives that are emerging across clients that are kind of emblematic of where the tech industry, I think, is going. One is this idea of doing more with less, especially post layoffs. It seems like a lot of our clients are navigating a difficult budget environment, a difficult headcount environment, and they're really seeking solutions that allow them to be more nimble and agile. And I think Duco has actually been a really good partner in those conversations because that's kind of the backbone of our model. The second thing that we're seeing is this convergence of different topic areas. So historically speaking, whereas like a fraud conversation might have been siloed to that team or a content review might have been siloed to that team, there is a lot more kind of dotted lines, especially with the emergence of AI. Everything is now touching everything. And so having one specific solution for one specific problem seems to be kind of a legacy idea. And it's now thinking about holistically and comprehensively an ecosystem of information, of users, and how do you kind of navigate that in a strategic way? And then I think that the final thing that has become increasingly obvious, especially again with the emergence of AI, is this acceleration of problem solving. I think tech has always moved quickly. It's kind of what it's been known for. But increasingly, it is not only about moving quickly, it's getting information, making that information actionable, and then iterating and seeing what happens with that. And I think that pace and that life cycle has only sped up. And so it's really interesting to see how Duco can play a role in those conversations with these partners, because I think the content that we're navigating is definitely evolving, but it's really about how we're doing that I think is actually changing more radically.
Yeah, that's great. And I think I want to pivot now towards a little bit of some of the, more of those trends that we are seeing. And I want to jump in first with a question about what is exciting you today about tech, but then also what is terrifying you. As you all know, I don't like to just do the doomsday stuff, but there is a lot of stuff that is changing at the moment and that we're looking at. And so, Sid, maybe I'll start with you in terms of what are the things that you're watching today that are like really getting you excited?
Yeah, I in general, I'm also kind of an optimist. I think that we have a lot of really big challenges ahead, but I think that there are a lot of really exciting things happening. I think one of the more interesting things that that I'm seeing is that a lot of big companies are going back to their startup roots and startup principles, which has been really cool to watch and kind of like energizing. It also comes with risks. And so what I mean by that is I think that a lot of them, I think there's an AI arms race happening right now that we're seeing. It's really interesting. The landscape feels more competitive than ever. However, a lot of these big companies that are competing are also partnering, which is super interesting. I think there's a massive focus on speed and doing product launches before products are perfect. That is, again, what startups do. And most of the big tech companies have moved away from that until OpenAI launched their GPT. And now they kind of gave permission to all these other AI products to kind of like launch before they're perfect. I think a lot of these companies are placing big bets and they're flattening their organizations and embracing a culture of experimentation. So for me, I think that that's one of the things that I'm noticing across the industry that I think is both exciting. And I think like makes things a little bit more interesting. And also obviously is going to have some downsides, particularly with digital, digital risks and safety.
Scott, how about you?
There's definitely a lot of action in the tech industry right now. And I think the thing that excites me is the same thing that is a little bit taxing on me, which really is just, as Sid mentioned, the pace of innovation here is insane, right? Because We're all sitting here very eager and very excited to accelerate, you know, our pace of being able to build what we want to build using all of these tools. And so I love being able to sit down and have my blank page start not so blank, right? I love that jumping off point. I love that my code lines finish themselves as my little AI co-pilots, you know, are helping me get through my day and my work. At the same time, the FOMO that exists in here, I don't know if you all are feeling this, but like, oh my gosh, as soon as I feel like I've picked up one tool and worked that into my workflow, it's obsolete because that was 2 weeks ago. Even something as simple as somebody showed me this music generating AI called Suno, right? And I'm having some fun with it. And as soon as I share it with a friend, they're like, oh, there's another one that's way better right now. You know, I mean, it's low stakes, but even still, you get to the end of the day and you're like, oh my gosh, how do I keep up with this? And then sitting in the seats that we're sitting in, you know that all this is happening and we can say it's a little bit overwhelming from a I'm trying to be productive perspective, right? But if you're to just tweak that a little bit and look at it from the perspective of I want to release this stuff to the world in a responsible way, I mean, like the task is gargantuan. It's also a heck of a lot of fun. This is pressure makes diamonds and friends are made in the foxholes and all this stuff. Love being in that zone. But I mean, holy smokes, if you're feeling overwhelmed, I promise you're not alone because I'm right there with you.
Yeah, we're definitely in this. I heard somebody call it a super cycle right now where there's just so much change happening in AI, wearables, and biotech that like it's just near impossible to process it all while it's all happening in such real time. Nima, last but certainly not least, I keep saying that, but what are you kind of excited about?
No,
what are you keeping an eye on?
Yeah, I mean, I think mine is kind of a blend of what Sydney and Scott alluded to, which is the proliferation of tools. And I think about it from a user perspective of like, if you're a user, you know, really anywhere in the world, you now have access to more efficient, different tools than maybe you ever had before, right? And I think we're in this really interesting moment where, you know, the traditional kind of analogy of like the adoption curve, I think we're in an acclimation curve. I think people are trying to figure out how to leverage these tools and figuring out, frankly, how to curate which ones are going to be most useful for their kind of day-to-day or week-to-week experience. And so I'm excited for the industry to kind of continue to develop all this optionality. And then I'm really interested to see what the other industries kind of do with that. And I think there will be a ripple effect, because I do think we will see maybe in the next 6 months, year, 2 years, I don't know how fast the life cycle will be, but how these things actually get embedded in our day-to-day lives, both professionally and personally. And I think that's really exciting for me, because I think just the way that we go about everything that we do is about to change if it hasn't already.
I want to ask you all a question based on that, because another thing that I look at, if you use a lot of these tools off the shelf, right, they do pretty good. They do a good job at hitting the good work bar, but they're not quite personalized yet, right? And so as you think through personalizing these things, it seems like the only way to do that right now is to turn all your data over to these orgs putting these models together, right? And they do have terms of service, and of course I trust these companies and they're doing the right thing. But as I talk to different folks, there's a perception or a hesitation in saying, I don't want to send my data into this tool because, you know, how do I know they're not going to use it for training, or is this data mine or not mine? And so I don't know, have any of you all like wanted to use a tool but then hesitated because you're thinking, you know what, I've really got to be mindful about where my personal data is going.
It hasn't prohibited me from using anything. It will change how I use it. So I can just use it and not put in anything that I think is sensitive. And then, as you guys know, we went through this like over the last couple of weeks. And then in other cases, you know, for the business, we're literally reading the terms of service, how they're using the data and all of that, and making decisions off that. So I think it's still helpful to, like, you can still dabble with things without feeling vulnerable. But I do think if you're putting more serious stuff in there, you have to be really, really thoughtful about that.
I think that's particularly relevant to our industry, because as all these folks are building these tools and new personal assistants and medallions that live on your clothing all day, in this case, I believe that, you know, the company with the best technology is certainly going to have a huge advantage. But in particular, with getting people to adopt these types of products, trust within your user base is going to be an insane premium, right? Because in order to get the full mileage out of these tools, we really want to open up our personal lives and data sets to them. And so the reputations of these companies as they're going into this new technology field, I think brand's going to play a lot bigger role here than it has in the past. And Katie, I know you've had a front row seat to how, you know, your brand can either greatly accelerate what you're trying to do, or it can be a bit of an obstacle. And so I think here that's just going to be on steroids.
Yeah, what I wanted to ask Sydney to go into maybe a little bit deeper, and maybe everybody, because I think a lot of people are interested. They're trying to think about how to incorporate AI into their daily life, into their work. Do they let their employees use it, et cetera? And so, you know, we are on the Google suite in terms of all the work that we do. And now they have Gemini for Workplace that we're all kind of testing out right now. And so, Sydney, I was hoping you could give a little bit more of, like, as the CEO, your thought process of what you went through to then turn that on for staff, and how you're asking people to try to start to incorporate this into the work that we're doing.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, I read how they're using our data for different things, and they have different pricing tiers, like a lot of companies, where at a certain level, and we paid for the enterprise level, they are not using our data for training or for any other purposes internally. And so I think that that's something you just have to be mindful of. I frankly think it just depends on the business as well. We deal with a lot of really sensitive information, and the nature of our work with our clients is usually incredibly confidential. And so I think that we've got to keep that in mind. I think for other companies, there's a different risk assessment. And so you really just have to think about what is good for you and your company. And then it's also just educating the team too on, you know, we want people to be innovating and we want people to be using these tools. I would never tell someone not to use a tool. Just be thoughtful about how you're using it and what you're putting in there. And there are a lot of ways you can do that that is useful, right? So for example, if you wanted to put together a financial model or write something about a certain client, you literally can just swap out certain things within that mock-up and then like add in at, like, once you are done with that, the terms or the things that you need to make it applicable to what you're doing. So I think there's a lot of, I don't think it's going to prohibit innovation if you're just smart about it.
Yeah, I'm really excited for us for proposal writing to like be able to be like, put this in our proposal format. Here's the main points. And then it like at least spits out that first draft for you to do that. And, you know, a lot of these tools are kind of productivity hacks in some ways. And so, you know, we all have a lot that is going on day to day. And so I wanted to ask each of you if there's any productivity or other hacks that you have that people might find helpful in sort of, you know, just getting through the day. And so Nima, let's start with you. What are some of the things that you do?
Yeah, I do a bunch of different things. I'm actually very interested to hear what others have to say. I'm a big fan of so there's something called the Pomodoro technique, which I'm sure some of you have heard of or used. It is basically this methodology of doing, you know, sprints of work and then taking breaks, short breaks, or longer breaks, depending on how many cycles you've done. But I find it's a really good way to kind of make sure that my mental energy stays high and I stay very acute on the things I'm doing, especially those things that are more detail oriented or require a lot of energy output. I find that if I'm sitting at a laptop for 8 hours a day, as many of us often do, the marginal return on my time is quickly but surely diminishing. And so getting that moment to step away, refresh mentally, refresh physically has been just absolutely critical to me. And then, I mean, one that seems probably fairly obvious to folks is pausing notifications on stuff. I feel like the dilution of concentration as you get like a ping here, a ping there, all the different apps we have open, like that context switching toll is real and severe, and I think way more severe than probably most people realize. And so when you're actually in it, be fully in it, and don't multitask, I think that has been an effective strategy, at least for me so far, even though, you know, you have to understand like what is truly urgent and what can actually wait, and everything can feel urgent, but what actually is, and actually taking the time to reconcile those things, I think is a useful exercise.
Yeah. One of the best things I did for my own mental sanity last year was to get rid of all the red dots, except for my text app and messaging apps and everything else I have to, because otherwise I found myself throughout the day, I'm like, oh my God, I got to clear the red dots, got to clear the red dots. And it was so, and then I also used the schedule send on the, or the scheduled summary on the phone, so that I only have notifications coming through for a few things. Cause it was amazing how much time it was, even if you tell yourself you shouldn't be distracted by it, like we've just been conditioned to be like, oh, there's something there you must go see. And, you know, to have that, Scott, what are some of the productivity hacks that you have, you want to share?
First of all, Nima, you're talking to a fellow Pomodoro, practitioner. I have a tomato clock, but it's at my other desk. I'm so disappointed at where I'm sitting because that was a bonding moment. So in terms of my own productivity, I've got two things to offer. And the first thing that I utilize and a tool that I bring out very often is this idea that you will learn a lot more from a quick experiment than you would from spending days thinking about something. And so for me, it's all about a bias towards action. And in tech parlance, we would call this a minimum viable product or an MVP. And so there's a lot of times where we can get these big grand ideas and you think about implementing them, and it would really be a summit. But if you can really distill that big idea down to the one thing that's the crux and run a test on that, I find that that's a huge way to just accelerate progress, trim and not go down less promising paths, and just propel the whole thing forward. It's also a lot more fun when you're building and trying things, as long as you're okay learning or failing, whatever you want to call that. So that would be one huge productivity hack that I utilize often. And I guess the other thing that I would throw out there just really quickly is that use copilots.
What's a copilot? Folks might not know.
Thank you. So when you think about generative AI and you think about using something like a ChatGPT, you're typing something in there and then it's giving you a very long response. So this is kind of back to minimum viable product, because now you're asking this model to ship you back a whole paragraph or a whole page of text. A copilot is really the shortcut to doing that, which is I'm going to start typing the sentence and I'll let the model just complete it for me. And what I find that does is it puts a lot less pressure on the model. You get a lot less frustrated because if it's not perfect, you just keep typing and things are fine. And you don't end up in this place where you spend more time trying to hone your prompt in to get the right output from your model than you would just starting from scratch and writing it yourself. So Again, just baby steps and progress. You can use a Copilot for software engineers. That would be GitHub Copilot. And then in Microsoft Word, well, Google has their Gemini Copilot. There's all sorts of Copilots out there. So just anything that you can do at the end of the day, it helps you type faster.
Yeah, I think it's like it's all this experimentation right now, right? Like everybody kind of has their own ways that they like to do things, and like some things might work, some things might not work, but like trying those different things out and adapting it to yourself and like what works for you is really important. Sydney, what are some of the hacks that you have?
So I'm going to not mention any technical ones because I feel like they're changing constantly. And I'm going to go with ones that have worked long-term, like behavioral hacks. One is just under promise and over deliver. I think that is just key in managing expectations. We really value speed and quality at Duco, and so do our clients. And that's why they work with us. And I think about that a lot with them too, is we have to move fast. We have to have quality. But when you come in early on something or you come in with higher quality, I think that that just goes such a long way. I think another one is just treating meetings and all of your encounters as if you're in a classroom, and just constantly be soaking up new things and learning and being intellectually curious. It's funny to think of that as a hack, but I often see people just go through the motions of their day, and it's just a really big missed opportunity in my mind that they're not like taking those, like leaning in and really being present to kind of study whatever the thing is or their surroundings. So I think those are the two that I would, that I focus on and have and really continue to focus on.
So to wrap this up, I thought we would do a little bit of predictions. This is a really hard time to do predictions beyond being like everything's going to be different 2 weeks from now, a couple months from now, but want to go through with each of you and kind of get a couple of predictions that you have. You can choose the time frame that you would like to use on this. But why don't we start with you, Scott, on this one. What are some predictions you have that people should be paying attention to?
Predictions looking into the future. So the first one that I'm fairly confident of is that, you know, history, as we move forward, it will not repeat, but it will rhyme. And as we have all of these things going on all over the world, all of these new tools, these things that folks are worried about, I think that there's a lot of comfort or advantage that you can get and just looking to similar scenarios in the past to watch those things play out. If you want to get a little bit juicier of a prediction here, sort of along those lines, we see right now that there are a lot of layoffs happening in our industry. We see that new productivity tools are causing, you know, roles to disappear or be augmented, or maybe there's fewer people that can accomplish the same thing. I still believe that humans are at the heart of all of this thing. But if I were to make a spicy prediction over the next 5 to 10 years, I think that actually W-2 employment is probably going to trend down. And I think that 1099 and contract-based employment that really surges and meets a business's current needs are going to be trending up. We saw similar things happen with pensions. Again, I'm not happy about the directions of these things, but as I kind of see these patterns playing out, I can think towards my future and those in my life and try to make sure that everyone's as prepared as possible for the adventures that lie ahead.
Sydney, how about you?
I think it's really hard to say. I think AI is just going to be layered in everything we do. I think there's going to be a moment where we don't even know if and when we're interacting with it. I think in a lot of cases that's already happening. I think like our you know, children and generations that come after us are just going to have completely different user experiences than we do. And the digital world and the real world aren't going to feel as separate as they do to us. I also think that when you're thinking about the future and work and all of that, Scott, too, just on that note, I think that people and companies that focus on innovation, learning, speed, and problem solving are just going to prevail. I think there are going to be a lot of really cool opportunities. And I think we, you know, humans are incredibly resilient, but I think the ones that are the most adaptable are going to really, frankly, like have really like find the next 10 years to be a lot of fun and very interesting.
And Nima?
Yeah, mine is probably a little bit more vague and probably a little bit of a longer time horizon, but I think it is similar to what both Scott and Sydney have said, I'm really curious to see the evolution of how information is captured and shared, especially with the emergence of AI. I think the way people and societies and communities think about shepherding information from generation to generation, or like being producers of new information, will start to change as AI gets stronger, more powerful, and frankly, starts to outpace what the human mind is capable of. I think the way we think about information will just evolve. And I think that ecosystem is going to look really interesting, maybe less so for like us on the call, but like maybe for my son's generation, or maybe the generation that comes after that. And so that is a very, very long-term kind of hypothesis, but I'm very interested to see how we kind of treat information in the future and how we think about how we use it, how we store it, how we pass it down. I think that's all going to evolve in a really interesting way.
I love it. Well, Sydney, Scott, and Nima, thank you so much for joining us. If folks want to learn more about Duco, you can go to DucoExperts.com, and I'll put the link in the show notes as well. But thank you all for joining. Thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Impossible Trade-Offs. You can find the show notes and everything for this podcast on my Substack at anchorchange.substack.com. I want to thank my guests for doing this, and this episode was edited by Claude Jennings Jr. I hope you all have a great day, and thank you so much.